Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, February 18th on Iris. I'm your reader, Aaron. Our first article on the front page, lagging areas to get their vaccines, Reynolds, counties with doses withheld to get their full supply, by Aaron Murphy and Michaela Ram Johnston. Five counties that had their expected doses of the COVID-19 vaccines temporarily withheld by the state will receive their supply and are expected to again this weekend, Governor Kim Reynolds and state public health officials said Wednesday. Doses of the COVID-19 vaccine were temporarily withheld last week in Washington, Chickasaw, Hancock, Poweshiek, and Buchanan counties because they had not reached a state-established threshold for distributing the vaccine, Reynolds said Wednesday during her weekly news conference, that the decision to withhold the vaccine doses was not a punishment, but rather to ensure all doses in the state's stockpile are immediately distributed. She said each of the five counties had several hundred unused doses of the vaccine and that their administration rates were between 25% and 53%. Quote, that was not meant to be punitive. Instead, it was intended to allow local public health officials a week to administer the remaining supply of vaccine before their next shipment arrived, Reynolds said. With demand for vaccine far exceeding supply, there's no reason that available doses should go unused week over week. Vaccines should be going into the arms of Iowans, not sitting in storage, end quote. Reynolds and state public health officials said they worked with all five counties, and they believe all five are resolving any issues and should be on track to receive their next weekly batch of vaccine doses as planned without interruption. Quote, we're working together to make that happen, end quote, Reynolds said. All counties will be getting more vaccine doses next week, Reynolds said. She said the federal government has informed Iowa that its weekly allotment will increase 24% next week from roughly 49,900 to almost 62,000. As COVID-19 testing is expected to continue becoming more widely available, the state public health department's tracking of COVID-19 test data is shifting away from the focus on individual testing and instead onto a broad look at virus spread during the 14-day incubation period. Starting this week, state public health officials will calculate Iowa's positivity rate by dividing the number of positive tests over a two-week period with the total number of tests, both negative and positive, in that same time period. This is the same method used by U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to calculate percent positivity. Currently, 14-day positivity rates reported daily by the Iowa Department of Public Health are computed by taking individuals who tested for the virus and dividing that number with the total individuals who received a COVID-19 test. The change, which will be reflected on the state's coronavirus tracking website by the end of the week, will likely result in a lower positivity rate overall for Iowa, IDPH Interim Director Kelly Garcia said during a press availability Wednesday. Iowans have easier access to testing than they did early in the pandemic, and the addition of at-home testing options expected to hit the market in the coming months would further limit the ability for the state to monitor testing at an individual level, Garcia said. Quote, as antigen testing became more readily available and commonly used for routine testing, the number of tests by individuals began increasing significantly. In fact, it really did skyrocket, and quote, Garcia told reporters. Quote, the process to duplicate these tests by individual became incredibly complex, end quote. Our next front page article, 400 sign up for shots in 2 hours. CG Public Health limits time slots to registration by phone, by Jared McNett, Globe Gazette. When CG Public Health held its latest round of COVID-19 vaccine registrations on Tuesday morning, it had a slight tweak to its ongoing approach. While its previous week's residents could call in or register online, time slots this week were only available by phone. Despite the shift in technique, the results weren't dramatically different. According to CG Public Health Director Brian Hanfit, it took a little less than 2 hours for 400 primary doses of COVID-19 vaccine to be assigned. With that, Hanfit said at Wednesday afternoon's press conference with Mason City Mayor Bill Shekel that he expected the department to shift back to its dual approach for next week's round of registrations on Monday morning. Quote, it seems to work best if we provide dual options, end quote, Hanfit said. Earlier in the day, CG Public Health held its first mass vaccination clinic of the week and used about 200 prime doses and 225 booster doses per Hanfit. On Friday, the plan is to do the same. CG Public Health has it set up now that when someone receives their first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, they'll be scheduled for their boost dose at the end of their appointment. The goal is to get people back in for their boost doses between 28 and 42 days after the first round was administered. HanFit has said that, so far, public health hasn't had a problem with those timelines. For those 65 and older who haven't gotten registered yet, HanFit urged people to keep the faith and keep trying to get in, and has said before that his department doesn't intend to move on from the age group until everyone in it who wants a vaccine can get one. He's also said that folks in that group who are homebound and want a vaccine can work with CG Public Health to try and get something more comfortable set up. Quote, we definitely reach out to those groups and those people, HanFit said. Along with continuing vaccinations for those age 65 and older, HanFit said that public health is trying to wind down its vaccinations for school teachers and staff in the coming days with a, quote, closed pod, end quote, on Saturday to try and get them done. While CG Public Health is still handling the lion's share of COVID-19 vaccinations, there are other emerging options in town that HanFit suggested people may consider. Hy-Vee has started making appointments for vaccines available, but as of Wednesday afternoon, none of the Mason City Hy-Vee locations have appointments available online. If someone does want to try and register through Hy-Vee's website, they should have their insurance card and a Medicare Part B red, white, or blue card ready to upload if they're a Medicare recipient. That registration can be found by going to the Health and Pharmacy section of the Hy-Vee.com, then clicking COVID-19 vaccines, and then clicking Find Appointments. Quote, you should reach out to your local pharmacies, talk with your pharmacist, and see if they're going to get it, end quote, HanFit said. But then he pointed out to Schickel that the supply of doses coming into pharmacies has tended to be smaller than what the public health is getting, and that there will need to be a lot more options to take the burden off of his department. Based on data from the Iowa Department of Public Health, Cerro Gordo County has had 2,026 completions of the vaccination series by county of residents. More than 4,000 vaccine series have been initiated. Statewide, 509,090 doses have been administered through Wednesday. Our last front page article, Mason City students, mayor for the day. Two essay contest winners sit in on a council tour City Hall by Jared McNett, Globe Gazette. When Clear Lake resident Katie Zeke-Foos was a kid, she got to serve as, quote, mayor for the day, end quote, with Mason City Mayor Bill Schuckel. Zeke-Foos was a fifth grader at Madison Elementary and won an essay contest that asked, quote, what would you do if you were mayor for the day, end quote. Zeke-Foos said she doesn't remember what she wrote about it, but it does recall going on a tour of the city and feeling represented. Quote, I just remember feeling listened to as a young person and being able to get a peek behind the curtain on what community leaders do, Zeke-Foos said. It was one of the first times I can remember looking at myself as being a leader, end quote. Wednesday morning, that all came full circle for Zeke-Foos as she helped organize a new iteration of, quote, mayor of the day, end quote, for Mason City. While Schickel is mayor again, the winning students are new. Two students, Carter Osmunden from North Iowa Christian School and Blair Smith from John Adams Middle School, won the essay contest and got a chance to sit in on the Tuesday night's city council meeting and tour City Hall on Wednesday morning, as well as field questions from a local radio station. Osmunden's essay revolved around giving better pay to Mason City police officers, while Smith wrote about stopping hunger by having another community kitchen location on the south end of town. Osmunden was partially inspired by a neighbor who is in law enforcement. Smith fondly recalled helping out at the local food bank once. Early into Wednesday's proceedings, both students were asked whether or not they could see themselves running for some kind of local public office in the future. Osmunden had reservations about the prospect, but Smith didn't hesitate to say, quote, yes, because I'm into this stuff, end quote. Following a radio Q&A, Smith and Osmunden then had the chance to meet with department heads from development services, engineering, fire personnel, and police to talk with them about what their days are like and how they serve the city. Zeke-Foos, who works with young people through Greater Iowa Youth for Christ, said that she was honored to be able to help out Schickel, Osmunden, and Smith for the years, quote, mayor for the day, end quote. She then went on to say that when talking with the kids about the whole process, she kept her advice simple. Quote, I just encouraged young people to take part in the opportunity, end quote. I am so sorry for all the mispronunciations of the names in that article. Moving to page 2 for more local news, Cerro Gordo's daily COVID-19 update, Wednesday, February 17th, data snapshot as of 10 a.m., 330,434 total lab confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Iowa, 4,933 total lab confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Cerro Gordo, 4,629 total recovered in Cerro Gordo, 225 total active cases in Cerro Gordo, 5,306 deaths in Iowa, 79 deaths in Cerro Gordo. A status report of monitoring and testing of COVID-19 in Iowa, including county-level data provided by the Iowa Department of Public Health, can be found at coronavirus.iowa.gov/#current-status. Daily percentage of individuals tested positive February 4th through February 17th, max 10%, minimum 0%. COVID-19 testing options. Mercy One Family Health Line, 641-428-7777. Quick Care Urgent Care Clinic, 641-450-7000. Mason City Community Health Center, 641-450-0601. Waypoint Medical, 641-357-1999. Test Iowa, 641-382-3500. U.S. Chamber of Commerce launches a Digital Vaccine Resource Center for Business Community. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce launched a comprehensive new digital resource center to ensure the business community has the information, tools, and templates it needs to navigate this critical phase of the pandemic response and get back to business. The COVID-19 Vaccines Digital Resources Center includes VACs, state-specific guidance and information, employer vaccine communication and strategy guidance, reliable safety and efficiency information, and more. Our next article, Floyd County Board of Supervisors looks to opt out of pay increase, by Jared McNett, Globe Gazette. When the new budget for Floyd County rolls around on July 1 of this year, there's a good chance that at least one number among hundreds will stay the same, supervisors' salaries. With the past two budgets, the Floyd County Board of Supervisors has approved salary increases as recommended by the Compensation Board. For the fiscal year that started July 1, 2020, the supervisors received a pay increase of 2%, which bumped their pay up to $40,098. In the latest instance, though, the county board is moving to decline any pay increase. The proposed pay bump from the Compensation Board was less than past years at 1.5%, but the county supervisors still unanimously moved to decline the recommendation at a special meeting this past Friday. According to board member Doug Cam, much of the motivation for that is budgetary. Quote, "We have a really tight budget, so we thought the first thing was to make an example of ourselves," he said. "We're asking everybody for whatever ideas they can, and that was the first and easiest one that we could come up with." End quote. Cam said that in the 10 years that he's served on the board, there's been a time or two where the supervisors similarly declined to take a pay increase. In this latest instance, Cam said that the reason for the tighter budget was in part owed to an ongoing project to construct a new law enforcement center in the county. In fact, on Friday, the board heard an update on the project, which included changes for things such as kitchen equipment, which were listed at $2,021.53, and, quote, drywall at skylights, end quote, for $3,243.10. All motions carried 3-0. During discussion on the law enforcement center item, there was a dissenting voice from a resident, Doug Lindemann, who worried about the money it would still take to finish the project. Cam made clear that certain budget issues could change before things are finalized in the coming weeks. Quote, "Nothing set in stone right now," he said. "Just a number shuffling game right now," end quote. A county board in the north central Iowa declining to pay a pay increase wouldn't be wholly out of the ordinary. Less than a month ago, the Cerro Gordo County supervisors unanimously chose to turn a recommended pay increase of 2.75% from the County Compensation Board. When they made the move, Supervisor Chris Watts pointed out that was the fifth year in a row the board had reached such a decision. Supervisor pay for Cerro Gordo County is about $52,000, which is the sixth highest county board salary in the state based on numbers from the Iowa State Association of Counties. On that same list for fiscal year 2021, Floyd County came in 18th for supervisors' pay. The lowest in the state was Adams County at $20,835, and the state average was $37,243, which is almost $3,000 less than Floyd County. Moving to page A5 for more state news. Iowa school funding bill on its way to governor. Measures include 2.4% increase, but some will see less state aid, by Rod Beauchart, special to the Globe Gazette, Des Moines. A $36.5 million increase will in state supplemental aid for Iowa's 327 K-12 public school districts next year is on its way to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk for her expected signature. Republicans who control the Iowa Senate voted 31-18 Wednesday to approve a 2.4% increase in state funding. The measure includes money to address equity and transportation issues that will boost per-pupil funding by $179 to $7,227 for fiscal 2022. The state this fiscal year spent $3.381 billion on elementary and secondary schools, or $7,048 per pupil in state supplemental aid to cover instructional cost. Quote, this is a solid funding bill that sets our schools on a predictable, reliable, fundable path into the future, end quote, said Senator Amy Sinclair, Republican of Allerton, chairwoman of the Senate Education Committee and floor manager for Senate File 269. Minority Democrats opposed the bill because of declining school enrollments resulting from parents keeping nearly 7,000 young children home out of COVID-19 safety concerns means the new funding level won't cover about $71 million that will be needed when those kids return this fall. The bill, they said, represents a $7.5 million cut to preschools. Quote, the schools are going to be cut in real terms, end quote, said Senator Herman Quirenbach, Democrat of Ames. Quote, we need to do a better job, end quote. Under the bill, 137 Iowa school districts will receive less state funding than they did the year, meaning they will have to rely on, quote, a budget guarantee, end quote, that supplements lower state aid with local property taxes in those districts. Democrats argued the state has a budget surplus and can afford to provide more K-12 funding so property taxpayers don't have to shoulder the cost. They unsuccessfully called on newly elected GOP senators to join them in trying to restore the projected cut to preschools that could eliminate up to 2,500 slots. Quote, it's okay to say I didn't run to cut preschool education, end quote, said Senator Rob Hogg, Democrat of Cedar Rapids. Quote, this is your gut check moment right now. Let's fix it now, end quote. Sinclair said Republicans in the House and Senate removed some separate K-12 funding issues dealing with costs for districts associated with providing in-person instruction during the pandemic. Those issues, she said, continue to be negotiated, and she expects the preschool issue would be addressed in that separate funding measure. Quote, we are going to fix it, but we're not going to fix it in this bill, end quote, she said. Senate Republicans initially proposed a 2.2% boost to in-base state aid, while House Republicans sided with the governor at 2.5% before both legislative branches agreed on 2.4% level. Quote, this bill does not cut education spending. Look at the bottom line. It just simply doesn't, end quote, Sinclair told her Senate colleagues. Quote, it is unfortunate that indeed some people chose not to be in school this year, and that does indicate a decline, end quote. Republican legislator grills state public health expert with anti-vaccination questions, by Aaron Murphy, Lee Des Moines Bureau, Des Moines. An Iowa lawmaker asked a series of anti-vaccination questions to one of the state's top public health experts Tuesday during a hearing on a legislative proposal to bar businesses from requiring their employees to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. Senator Jim Carlin, a Republican from Sioux City, chaired the Iowa Senate hearing on the legislation, which would bar businesses, including hospitals and other healthcare providers, from requiring their employees to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. The bill also would allow students to seek an exemption from a school's vaccine requirement. These legislative hearings typically feature rapid-fire comments from dozens of organizations and individuals who are interested in a bill. Tuesday's hearing on this bill for a time featured Carlin asking a series of questions from an anti-vaccination former healthcare worker who said she quit her job because she refused to receive the flu shot. Then Carlin asking another series of questions to Dr. Caitlin Padatti, the state epidemiologist. Carlin said he has seen cases where vaccinations have led to personal injury and asked Padatti daddy questions like why chronic disease appears to be more prevalent and why autism is more frequently diagnosed than it was when he was a student. Padati assured Carlin that vaccines, including the COVID-19 vaccine, are run through rigorous testing processes to ensure they are safe and effective, not only before development, but also after. She said vaccines are, quote, absolutely critical public health tools, end quote. Quote, what's important to know is the benefit and the impact of these really awful diseases that used to spread widespread disease and death, Padati said. Children used to die routinely of diseases that I've never seen before because of vaccines. Vaccines continue to be a critical and remarkable life-saving tool that I think are incredibly important in keeping people safe and healthy here, end quote. The rest of the hearing's public comment period featured a mixture of people who supported the legislation, largely stating their concerns with vaccinations in general, and public health and infectious disease experts who relayed the important role vaccines in fighting infectious diseases. Carlin said his proposal aims to balance the interests of businesses and healthcare facilities that want their workers to receive the COVID-19 vaccine against, quote, a person's legitimate interest in having autonomy over their own body, end quote. He also expressed concern that businesses would use information in a state database to determine whether Iowans have received the COVID-19 vaccine and use that information to prevent anyone who has not received the vaccine from patronizing or working at their business. A state public health department official said businesses would not have access to any state database with that kind of personal health information. Moving to the nation and world section, winter weather, icy blast hampers shots, nearly 3.4 million without power, expert says no snow days with virus, Associated Press. The icy blast across much of the U.S. injected more confusion and frustration into the nation's COVID-19 vaccination drive Wednesday, just when it was gathering speed, snarling vaccine deliveries, and forcing the cancellation of countless shots around the country. Across a large swath of the nation, including deep south states like Georgia and Alabama, the snowy, slippery weather either led to the closing of vaccination sites outright or held up the necessary shipments, with the delays expected to continue for days. Almost 3.4 million customers around the U.S. were still without electricity, and some also lost water service. Texas officials ordered 7 million people to boil tap water before drinking it after days of record low temperatures that damaged infrastructure and froze pipelines. The latest storm front was certain to complicate recovery efforts, especially in the states that are unaccustomed to such frigid weather, parts of Texas, Arkansas, and the lower Mississippi Valley. Quote, there's really no let up to some of the misery people are feeling across that area, end quote, said Bob Orvac, lead forecaster with the National Weather Service, referring to Texas. This week's extreme weather has been blamed for the deaths of more than 30 people, some of whom perished while struggling to keep warm inside their homes. In New York, Mayor Bill de Blasio said doses expected this week were delayed by weather elsewhere in the country, forcing the city to hold off making 30,000 to 35,000 vaccination appointments. One public health expert said the delays were unacceptable. Quote, having vaccine centers take snow days is just going to back things up more than they already are, end quote, said Dr. Amesh Adija, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Quote, the virus doesn't take snow days, end quote. Adija said people in charge of vaccination efforts must find ways to be more resilient to weather. Quote, just like mailmen can deliver the mail through sleet or snow, end quote. He suggested clinics use better contingency plans. In Washington, White House COVID-19 coordinator Jeff Zients said that in places where vaccination venues have been closed, like Texas, the government is encouraging sites to increase their hours once they are open. The U.S. is vaccinating an average of 1.7 million Americans per day against COVID-19, up from under 1 million a month ago. New figures from the White House show a steady increase in the pace of vaccinations over President Joe Biden's first month in office. Our next article, conservative radio host dies. Limbaugh had cancer. His wife announced his death on his show, by Matt Sidensky, Associated Press. Rush Limbaugh, the talk radio host who ripped into liberals and laid waste to political correctness with a captivating brand of malice and made him one of the most powerful voices in politics, influencing the rightward push of American conservatism and the rise of Donald Trump, died Wednesday. He was 70 years old. Limbaugh said a year ago that he had lung cancer. His death was announced on his show by his wife, Catherine. Limbaugh galvanized listeners for more than 30 years with his talent for sarcastic, insult-laced commentary. He called himself an entertainer, but his three-hour weekday radio show broadcast on nearly 600 U.S. stations helped shape the national political conversation, swaying ordinary Republicans in the direction of their party. Quote, in my heart and soul, I know I have become the intellectual engine of the conservative movement, end quote, Limbaugh, with typical immodesty, told author Zev Shavitz in the 2010 book, quote, Rush Limbaugh, an Army of One, end quote. He routinely trafficked in lies and conspiracies with contempt for his opposition that veered into cruelty. When actor Michael J. Fox, suffering from Parkinson's disease, appeared in a Democratic campaign commercial, Limbaugh mocked his tremors. When a Washington advocate for the homeless killed himself, he cracked jokes. As the AIDS epidemic raged in the 1980s, he made the dying a punchline. He was frequently accused of bigotry and blatant racism. Trump, like a long line of conservative politicians before him, heaped praise on Limbaugh, and during the last year's State of the Union speech, awarded him the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. Limbaugh influenced the likes of Sean Hannity, Glenn Beck, Bill O'Reilly, and countless other conservative commentators. Quote, what he did to bring a paranoia and really mean, nasty rhetoric and hyper-partisanship into the mainstream, and quote, said Martin Kaplan, a University of Southern California professor who is an expert on the intersection of politics and entertainment and a frequent critic of Limbaugh. His fourth wife, the former Catherine Rogers, whom he married in 2010, survives him. He had no children. Our next article, Biden supports reparations study. House panel weighs bill to examine slavery discriminatory policies, by Kevin Frecking, Associated Press, Washington. President Joe Biden's White House is giving its support to studying reparations for Black Americans, boosting Democratic lawmakers who are renewing efforts to create a commission on the issue amid the stark racial disparities highlighted by the COVID-19 pandemic. The House panel heard testimony Wednesday on legislation that would create a commission to examine the history of slavery in the U.S., as well as the discriminatory government policies that affected former slaves and their descendants. The commission would recommend ways to educate the American public of its findings and suggest appropriate remedies, including financial payments from the government to compensate descendants of slaves for years of unpaid labor by their ancestors. Even with Democrats controlling both chambers of Congress and the White House, passing a reparations bill could prove difficult. The proposal has languished in Congress for more than three decades, winning fresh attention in 2019. Only 29% of Americans voiced support for paying cash reparations, according to an Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll taken in the fall of 2019. Most Black Americans favored reparations, 74% compared with 15% of white Americans. Our next article, U.S. seizes millions of fake N95 masks. Investigations focused on counterfeits sold to medical facilities, Associated Press, Washington. Federal agents have seized more than 10 million fake 3M brand N95 masks in recent weeks, the result of an ongoing investigation into counterfeits sold in at least five states to hospitals, medical facilities, and government agencies. The most recent seizures occurred Wednesday when Homeland Security agents intercepted hundreds of thousands of counterfeit 3M masks in an East Coast warehouse that were set to be distributed, officials said. Investigators also notified about 6,000 potential victims in at least 12 states, including hospitals, medical facilities, and others who may have unknowingly purchased knockoffs, urging them to stop using the medical-grade masks. Officials encouraged medical workers and companies to go to 3M's website for tips on how to spot fakes. Quote, not only do they give a false sense of security, how dangerous is the exposed individual without any protective gear? They have no utility whatsoever, end quote, Homeland Security Secretary Ali Mayorkas said of the fake masks. The masks do not come through 3M's regular distributors. They come from outside the normal supply chain, officials said. But hospitals and medical groups have increasingly gone around normal purchasing routines during mask shortages in the global pandemic, officials said. Digest, stimulus checks boost retail sales. New York retail sales soared a seasonally adjusted 5.3% in January from the month before, the U.S. Commerce Department said Wednesday. It was the biggest increase since June. The $600 stimulus checks sent out at the end of last year pushed people to buy new furniture, clothing, and appliances. Retail sales slumped in the last 3 months of 2020 as stimulus money dried up, job growth was non-existent, and a surge in virus cases kept people away from stores during the critical holiday shopping season. In fact, the Commerce Department said Wednesday that December's drop was actually larger than its first reported, revised to be down 1% instead of a decrease of 0.7%. President Joe Biden is trying to push through a $1.9 trillion stimulus plan, which would include $1,400 in direct payments to most Americans. U.S. charges North Koreans and hacks. Washington. The Justice Department charged three North Korean computer programmers and a broad range of global hacks, including a destructive attack targeting an American movie studio and in the attempted theft and extortion of more than $1.3 billion from banks and companies, federal prosecutors said Wednesday. The newly unsealed indictment builds off a criminal case brought in 2018 and adds two additional North Korean defendants. Prosecutors identified all three as members of a North Korean military intelligence agency. Or alarmingly to U.S. officials, the defendants worked at times from locations in Russia and China. Law enforcement officials say the prosecution highlights the profit-driven motive behind North Korea's criminal hacking, in contrast from other adversarial nations like Russia, China, and Iran, who are generally more interested in espionage, intellectual property theft, and even disrupting democracy. Briefly, agency hacks. U.S. authorities are still working to unravel the full scope of the likely Russian hack that gave the, quote, sophisticated, end quote, actor behind the breach complete access to files and emails from at least nine government agencies and about 100 private companies, the top White House cybersecurity official said Wednesday. Israel. U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke by phone Wednesday after a month of silence that raised concerns in Israel about a frostier relationship between the two allies. Myanmar. Tens of thousands of demonstrators flooded the streets of Myanmar's biggest city Wednesday in one of the largest protests yet of a coup, despite warnings that recent troop movements could indicate the military was planning a violent crackdown. Mars. The NASA rover Perseverance was headed Thursday for a compact 5-mile by 4-mile patch on the edge of an ancient Martian river delta. The once submerged terrain could hold evidence of past life, all the more reason to gather samples at this spot for return to Earth in 10 years. Shootings. At least 8 people were wounded by gunfire Wednesday near a transit station in North Philadelphia, and one was critically injured, police said. Police reported 2 firearms recovered and 1 person in custody. Death threat. A Pakistani Taliban militant who 9 years ago is alleged to have shot and badly wounded Nobel Laureate Malala Yousafzai has threatened a second attempt on her life, tweeting that next time, quote, there would be no mistake, end quote. Twitter on Wednesday permanently suspended the account with the menacing post. Moving to the obituaries, Arthur H. Kalvig, Northwood. Arthur H. Kalvig, 92, of Northwood, passed away peacefully Tuesday, February 16, 2021, at the IOOF home in Mason City with family at his side. Arrangements are pending with Connor Colonial Chapel. Connor Colonial Chapel, 1008 First Avenue South, Northwood, Iowa, 50459. Phone number 641-324-1543. colonialchapels.com. Scott Baraghi, Mason City. Scott Baraghi, 51, of Mason City, passed away Saturday, February 13, 2021, at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center. Massive Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, February 19, 2021, at Epiphany Parish St. Joseph Catholic Church, 302 5th Street, Southeast Mason City, with Reverend Neil Manitarench celebrant. Following the mass, cremation rites will be accorded and interment will be held at a future date in Memorial Park Cemetery, Mason City. Visitation will be held 4:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. Thursday, February 18, 2021 at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street Northeast, Mason City, where a scriptural wake service will begin at 7 p.m. Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street Northeast, Mason City, 641-423-2372, colonialchapels.com. Dr. Stephen Peter Gotez, Mason City, Iowa. Dr. Stephen Peter Gotez, 58 of Coralville, Iowa, formerly of Mason City, Iowa, passed away on Tuesday, February 16, 2021, after a valiant 23-month battle with an aggressive bladder cancer, never once wavering in his faith in our Lord Jesus Christ. There will be no public visitation. A massive Christian burial for friends and co-workers will be held at Epiphany Parish Holy Family Catholic Church, 722 North Adams Avenue, Mason City, on Monday, February 22, 2021 at 10:30 a.m. with Reverend Neil Mantarach officiating. A rosary will be said at 9:30 a.m. Monday morning at the church in Mason City, where masks will be required. A second mass of Christian burial for family and friends, followed by burial in the church cemetery, will be held at St. Clement Catholic Church in Bowling Green, Missouri, on Saturday, February 27th, 2021 at 10:30 a.m. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made to Dr. Stephen Gotez and Barbara Schroeder Gotez, Laboratory Medicine and Nursing Scholarship, CO, Mercy One North Iowa Foundation, Schroeder Bros Agriculture Scholarship, CO, Isidore Raphael Charitable Fund, Epiphany Parish, Mason City, Iowa, St. Winclaus Catholic Church, Iowa City, Iowa, St. Clement Catholic Church, Bowling Green, Missouri, or any local charity that supports feeding the hungry, assisting the elderly or homeless, or protecting the unborn. Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street Northeast, Mason City, 641-423-2372, colonialchapels.com. Moving to sports, prep roundup. Season ends for Newman Catholic girls, Gunner Davis Globe Gazette. The Newman Catholic girls basketball team held its second home playoff game against Waterloo Christian in the Class 1A Region 1 quarterfinal on Tuesday night. Although the score was close at halftime, the Knights couldn't keep up with the Regents in the second half. Waterloo Christian earned a 56-33 win over Newman Catholic, ending the Knights' season. The Regents got out to a 3-point lead after the first quarter and only led 25-21 at halftime. The Knights didn't come out of the break with the same energy as the first half and were outscored 31-12 in the final 16 minutes. Junior Elise Ball led the Knights with 11 points, while senior Keelan Curley finished with 9 points in her final game. The Knights shot just 21.8% from the field. Newman Catholic earned a 4th place finish in the top of Iowa East and finished with an overall record of 12-11. Girls basketball, Bishop Garrigan 79, Northwood Kensett 24. The Northwood Kensett girls basketball team's season came to a close at the hands of the top-ranked team in Class 1A. Bishop Garrigan rolled through the Vikings on Tuesday 79-24. The Golden Bears got out to a 26-2 lead after the first quarter and never looked back. Junior Marley Backus led the Vikings with 8 points. Northwood Kensett finished the year with an overall record of 6-15. West Fork 55, South Hamilton 37. The West Fork girls basketball team had no trouble handling South Hamilton in the Class 2A Region 6 quarterfinals on Tuesday night. The Warhawks beat the Hawks 55-37 in Sheffield. West Fork got out to a 13-4 lead after one quarter and led by 8 points at the half. The Warhawks were able to outscore the Hawks in both the third and fourth quarter to earn the win. Senior Mackenzie Fessler and junior Maddie Hubuka each had 11 points for the Warhawks. West Fork improved to an overall record of 14-7 and play at home against West Hancock in the semifinals on Friday. St. Axnar 66, Wapsie Valley 39. The Class 1A No. 3 St. Axnar girls basketball team rolled through Wapsie Valley in the regional quarterfinal on Tuesday night. The Saints beat the Warriors 66-39. Senior Gracie Erbstach had 19 points, to lead the Saints offensively. Senior Brooklyn Hackbart finished with 12 points and 9 rebounds. St. Agnes is now 20-1 overall and will play on Friday at home in the regional semifinal against Nashua Plainfield. West Hancock 59, Mason City Northwest Webster 39. The Class 2A number 14 West Hancock girls basketball team rolled to a 20-point win over Manson Northwest Webster on a Tuesday. The Eagles beat the Cougars 59-39 to advance to the next round. There were no additional stats available for either team on Varsity Bound. West Hancock will continue its season in the regional semifinals on Friday at home against West Fork. Boys basketball, Janesville 69, Northwood Kensett 41. The Janesville's boys basketball team stormed through Northwood Kensett on a Tuesday night. The Wildcats beat the Vikings 69-41 in the first round of the Class 1A playoffs. There were no additional stats available on Varsity Bound. The Vikings finished up their year with an overall record of 7-13. Girls bowling, Mohawks take third at district meet. The Mason City girls bowling team took part in the district meet at Des Moines Lincoln on Tuesday night. The Mohawks took third place out of six teams with a score of 2,456 pins. This third place finish was the best finish of the last 6 years, according to Mason City head coach Larry Collins. The top individual scorer for Mason City was sophomore Maggie Eriks. She bowled a 376 total with a high game of 195. Juniors Haley Wendell and Eva Hort finished with 341 and 328 pins, respectively. Collins was proud of his team's effort, calling it, quote, a great year, end quote. Our next sports article, North Iowa basketball players earn honors. Top of All Iowa unveils all-conference teams by Shane Lance, Globe Gazette. With the playoff underway in Iowa high school sports, postseason honors have started to be announced. On Tuesday, the Top of Iowa announced its all-conference basketball teams, along with players and coaches of the year. On the girls' side, Bishop Garrigan sophomore Audie Crooks won the West Division Player of the Year, while OCH's Danny Johnson and St. Agnes' Haley Anderson won co-players of the year honors in the East. On the boys' side, Bishop Garrigan's Angelo Winkle was named TIC West Player of the Year, while Coach of the Year went to Lake Mills Coach Kyle Menke, who has led his team to a perfect 22-0 regular season. In the East, longtime West Fork skipper Frank Skunus won the honor after his team went a perfect 15-0 in conference play. Top of Iowa boys all-conference teams. East first team, Austin Bieneman, senior Nashua Plainfield, Doug Taylor, sophomore Newman Catholic, Eric Bobinette, senior Osage, Nathan Havel, junior Osage, Justice Jones, senior Rockford, Caden Ames, senior West Fork, Jacob Washington, senior West Fork, second team, Angel Jose, junior Central Springs, Max Birch, sophomore Newman Catholic, James Jennings, junior Newman Catholic, Caleb Salgi, senior North Butler, Caden Roberts, senior Northwood Kensett, Tyler Oberfell, junior OCH, Ryan Cole, senior St. Agnes, Kale Weaver, senior West Fork. Honorable mention, Drew Kelly, junior Central Springs, Bo Harrington, sophomore Nashua Plainfield, James Matthews, senior Newman Catholic, Corbin Lewis, sophomore North Butler, Kale Julseth, senior Northwood Kensett, Max Kunzenson, freshman OCH, Colton Lehman, junior Rockford, Braden Powers, senior St. Agnes, Joe Ingham, senior West Fork. Player of the Year, Austin Bieneman, Nashua Plainfield. Coach of the Year, Frank Skunas, West Fork. West first team, Angelo Winkle, senior Bishop Garrigan, Noah Miller, senior Forest City, Kevin Myers, senior GHV, Zach Zuby, senior GHV, Caleb Bacon, senior Lake Mills, Deshaun Lennon, senior Lake Mills, Dominic Price, senior North Iowa, second team, Carson Lane, senior Belmont Clemmy, Kyle Scaffey, senior Bishop Garrigan, Andrew Snyder, junior Forest City, Hayden Hutchinson, senior GHV, Wyatt Helming, junior Lake Mills, Kaysen Barnes, senior West Hancock, Rylan Barnes, sophomore West Hancock. Honorable mention, Caleb Carlson, senior Belmont Clemmy, Joseph Meese, senior Bishop Garrigan, Chase Mason, senior Eagle Grove, Carter Bruckhoff, junior Forest City, Brody Benke, senior GHV, Bennett Berger, junior Lake Mills, Logan Sabin, junior North Iowa, Gage Madden, senior North Union, Braden Walker, junior West Hancock. Player of the Year, Angelo Winkle, Bishop Garrigan. Coach of the Year, Kyle Menke, Lake Mills. Top of Iowa girls all-conference teams. East, first team, Brianna Heckman, junior, Nashua Plainfield, Danny Johnson, senior, Osage, Ellie Bobinette, senior, Osage, Hallie Anderson, senior, St. Agsnar, Brooklyn Heckbart, senior, St. Agsnar, Gracie Erbstach, senior, St. Agsnar, Emma Martinick, sophomore, West Fork, second team, Olivia Harms, junior, Central Springs, Jenna Carpenter, junior, Nashua Plainfield, Keelan Curley, senior, Newman Catholic, Madison Clipperton, senior, North Butler, Samantha Brandu, sophomore, Osage, Madison Hillman, sophomore, St. Agsnar, Adriana Cruz, junior, St. Agsnar, Riley Atkins, sophomore, West Fork. Honorable mention, Kaylee Fessler, junior, Central Springs, Chloe Matthews, senior, Nashua Plainfield, Molly McGuire, senior, Newman Catholic, Meg Thompson, junior, North Butler, Carly Hengstag, senior, Northwood Kensett, Cabri Sullivan, junior, Osage, Gabby Keith, senior, Rockford, Taylor Hannah, senior, St. Agsnar, Maddie Hubucka, junior, West Fork. Co-players of the year, Danny Johnson, Osage, and Hallie Anderson, St. Agsnar. Co-coaches of the year, Chad Erickson, Osage, Scott Cake Rice, St. Agsnar. West, first team, Audie Crooks, sophomore, Bishop Garrigan, Molly Joyce, sophomore, Bishop Garrigan, Kaylin Myers, senior, Bishop Garrigan, Shay Delvue, junior, Forest City, Chloe Frank, junior, GHV, Kennedy Kelly, junior, West Hancock, Rachel Lehrer, senior, West Hancock, second team, Addison McMurray, senior, Belmont Clemmy, Ellie Kaler, senior, Forest City, Kaylee Miller, senior, Forest City, Jaden Frank, senior, GHV, Liz Richardson, junior, GHV, Sam Nielsen, junior, North Union, Vanessa Vaughn Bank, senior, North Union, honorable mention, Jenna Meyer, junior, Belmont Clemmy, Abby Kapasis, freshman, Bishop Garrigan, Lee Friedel, senior, Eagle Grove, Hannah Good, senior, Forest City, Morgan Ryerson, senior, GHV, Ella Steen, sophomore, Lake Mills, Emma Duve, junior, North Iowa, Olivia Vaughn Bank, sophomore, North Union, Mallory Lehrer, freshman, West Hancock, player of the year, Audie Crooks, Bishop Garrigan, coach of the year, Merle Tiggs, North Union. Looking back, today is Thursday, February 18th, the 49th day of 2021. There are 316 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history, on February 18th, 1970, the, quote, Chicago Seven, end quote, defendants were found not guilty of conspiring to incite riots at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Five were convicted of violating the Anti-Riot Act of 1968. Those convictions were later reversed. On this date, in 1546, Martin Luther, leader of the Protestant Reformation in Germany, died in Elsbin. In 1564, artist Michelangelo died in Rome. In 1930, photographic evidence of Pluto, now designated a dwarf planet, was discovered by Clyde W. Tombaugh at Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona. In 1943, Madame Chiang Kai-shek, wife of the Chinese leader, addressed members of the Senate and then House, becoming the first Chinese national to address both houses of the U.S. Congress. In 1960, the 8th Winter Olympic Games were formally opened in Squaw Valley, California, by Vice President Richard M. Nixon. In 1967, American theoretical physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer died in Princeton, New Jersey, at age 62. In 1972, the California Supreme Court struck down the state's death penalty. In 1983, 13 people were shot to death at a gambling club in Seattle's downtown Chinatown in what became known as the Wami Massacre. Two men were convicted of the killings and are serving life sentences. A third was found guilty of robbery and assault. In 1988, Anthony M. Kennedy was sworn in as an Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1997, astronauts on the Space Shuttle Discovery completed their tune-up of the Hubble Space Telescope after 33 hours of spacewalking. The Hubble was then released using the shuttle's crane. In 2001, veteran FBI agent Robert Philip Hansen was arrested, accused of spying for Russia. Hansen later pleaded guilty to espionage and attempted espionage and was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Auto racing star Dale Earnhardt Sr. died in a crash at the Daytona 500. He was 49 years old. In 2003, an arson attack involving two South Korean subway trains in the city of Digo claimed 198 lives. The arsonist was sentenced to life in prison, where he died in 2004. 10 years ago, the United States vetoed a UN resolution that would have condemned Israeli settlements as illegal and called for a halt in all settlement building. The 14 other Security Council members voted in favor of the measure. 5 years ago, in what was seen as a criticism of Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump, Pope Francis said that a person who advocated building walls was, quote, not Christian, end quote. Trump quickly retorted it was, quote, disgraceful, end quote, to question a person's faith. A Vatican spokesman said the next day that the Pope's comment was not intended as a personal attack on Trump. Dallas-based Heritage Auctions said a rare copy of a comic book featuring the first appearance of Spider-Man had been sold to an anonymous collector for $454,100. 1 year ago, Japanese health authorities confirmed 88 more cases of the coronavirus aboard the quarantined cruise ship Diamond Princess, bringing the number of cases on board to 542. U.S. officials said Americans who chose to remain on board could not return home for at least 2 weeks after coming ashore. Health officials in the Chinese city of Wuhan announced that a hospital director who'd mobilized the hospital's resources to deal with the thousands of sick people arriving daily had died from the virus. President Donald Trump commuted the 14-year prison sentence of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich for political corruption. Blagojevich left prison hours later and returned home to Chicago. An Invisible Art, 7 Films That Are Great Examples of the Work Movie Editors Do, by Chris Hewitt, Star Tribune. What makes a movie is the editing, says Zach Steinberg in the documentary The Cutting Edge. Admittedly, Steinberg is an editor, most famously of the Matrix movies, but he's not wrong. Editing can create emotion, speed up or slow the pace, explore the psychology of a character, or find meaning that even the actors and writers didn't know was there. Along with the director, an editor decides what we look at and for how long. You'll find examples in the clip filled and entertaining The Cutting Edge, which examines the art of editing and which you can watch for free on YouTube. In it, we see editing legend Walter Murch solve problems created in the filming of Cold Mountain. Hear his compadres talk about why it's so much fun to work on chase scenes. Learn why women broke into the craft much earlier than others. Spoiler alert, sexism worked in their favor. And see how famous scenes might have been altered if an editor had made different choices. The job is one of the most misunderstood in Hollywood. You'll often hear it said, quote, why didn't the editor make it shorter, end quote, which misrepresents the role of an editor, who is more likely to determine how individual shots fit within scenes than the movie's length. That's a director's or producer's call. Even Oscar voters get it wrong. They generally throw up their hands and award the editing statue to the best picture winner unless there is a flashier option. The Cutting Edge is mostly about American movies, but it pays tribute to the pioneering 50s and 60s French editors whose jittery technique spread to Hollywood films such as Bonnie and Clyde and continues to this day in, for instance, Moonlight. It also acknowledges the founders of editing, many of them Russian, who figured out the basics such as the Kuleshov effect, which established that you could juxtapose a blank-faced actor with an image of, say, a birthday cake or a dead body, and the audience would interpret the blank expression as showing emotions such as a delight or horror. We don't notice it, but this effect is in literally every movie. These greats say a lot about the editors who decide what makes the cut. Jaws, 1975. The tension created in Jaws has so much to do with the Verna Fields skill that, in Cutting Edge, Steven Spielberg says that they often battled over her instance in that eliminating just 2 frames would make most scenes better, and that she was always right. Rear Window, 1954. At least as far back as Battleship Potemkin, in the silent era, movies have used editing to build suspense with altering points of view. An almost unbearably tense example is the practically dialogue-free George Tusami edited scene where Grace Kelly stumbles upon a murderer while Jimmy Stewart watches from across the courtyard, unable to intercede. Raging Bull, 1980, Martin Scorsese is making an adaptation of Killers of the Flower Moon right now, and that means editor Thelma Schoonmaker is making a new movie, too. She has been with Scorsese in the editing suite since 1967. She's won 3 Oscars for Scorsese movies, triple his total, including this one, in which the slowed-down, sped-up, knocked-sideways boxing scenes are the most striking. Out of Sight, 1998. Possibly inspired by a scene from Don't Look Now, a sexy, mixed chronology George Clooney, Jennifer Lopez snogfest gets most of the attention, but I love the little moments where editor Ann V. Coates and director Steve Soderbergh cut away from the main character to someone in the gifted cast for a reaction shot. Mulholland Drive, 2001. David Lynch has said that a key to enjoying his movies is a willingness to get lost. Mary Sweeney, who edited Mulholland Drive, and several others for Lynch, has said that she's like the movie ongoing public's first pair of eyes because she usually doesn't know what's going on when she starts working on his films. As a result, a big part of her job is massaging footage to that moment where a dreaming logic emerges for her and hopefully audiences. Mad Max Fury Road, 2015. Another editing Oscar, another movie long chase scene. George Miller's masterwork in this nonstop action, so heavily chopped up that it could be chaotic, but even as trucks are doing backflips and trapeze artists are firing cannons at each other, editor Margaret Sixel makes sure it's clear where we are and what's going on. And lastly, Memento, 2000. There's no obviously edited movie, since half of Christopher Nolan's tricky thriller is in chronological order and is half backwards. That it even makes sense in that the actors' performances track so beautifully was celebrated by the Motion Pictures Editors Guild, which called Dottie Dorn's efforts the 14th best edited movie of all time. The out-of-order work of another great, the late Sally Menke on Pulp Fiction, may have inspired Dorn. Around the league, Stars have another game postponed, Dallas. The league announced on Wednesday morning that Thursday's Stars-Tampa Bay Lightning game would be postponed, quote, as a result of ongoing power issues caused by severe weather in the Dallas area and after consultation with Dallas Mayor Eric Johnson's office, end quote, the NHL said. The decision to postpone came after games Monday and Tuesday against the Nashville Predators were postponed. The next scheduled Stars game is Saturday against Tampa Bay at the American Airlines Center. The latest postponement in this is the 7th of the season for the Stars, who lost their first 4 games of the season due to a COVID-19 outbreak during training camp. Only New Jersey has played fewer games than the Stars, 12, should Dallas restart its schedule Saturday versus the Lightning and end it May 10th as currently scheduled. The Stars will play their final 44 games in 80 days. Rangers lose Trouba to injury, New York. The Rangers will be without defenseman Jacob Trouba for the next 4 to 6 weeks because of a broken thumb. Quote, it's a tough loss, end quote, said top defenseman Adam Fox, whose team has lost 4 straight games. Quote, injuries are kind of part of the game, but you lose one of your veteran guys on the D corps, it hurts, end quote. MVP finalists are Temi Panarin is expected to return Thursday against Philadelphia after missing the past 2 games with a lower body injury. And with that, we will end out the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for today, Thursday, February 18th on IRIS. I'm your reader, Aaron. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you have a wonderful day.